So I believe this is the time we should start. Good morning. I'm Professor Xin Li, and this is the 21st APNIC Open Policy Meeting in the database SIG. And today, actually, the agenda is quite simple. And there is no proposals, only informational presentations. And before the real presentation there, the first item is like status on proposal for who is database query. And so I will report the situation on this, the status. And the background, the proposal for who is database query, proposal 019, version 001, sent to database SIG mailing list 10th February 2004. And the details of the proposal can be found in the following URL. However, when the proposal summary is, when a Whois client query at a NIC's Whois server will know that requested information can be resolved from the LIR server. Number one, the Whois server can find the LIR's DNS server for that IP address's reverse zone record. And the second, LIR's DNS server can respond Whois query, otherwise back to the conventional Whois working model. And the number three, ISP LIR's DNS server selecting fields from local database, then feedback to Whois server. So that this is the basic concept. However, proposer not available to present the proposal at APNIC 17th. And the proposer has been contacted periodically since then, but no response. What to do with the proposal now? So this is the question. Any comments on this? And also for this proposal, the mailing list is quite quiet, so no arguments, no debates, no discussion. Is there any suggestion or comments for this kind of case? This is the first case. So if we can make a decision, then in the future we can follow this case. Any comments, suggestions? Frankly speaking, the database mailing list is very, very quiet. There are about 3 spams per week, that's all. No comments?
This is Izumi from JPNIC. Can't we confirm on the mailing list if people are interested to discuss this issue? And if there's no response, maybe we can just drop it from the agenda.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay, I believe that's the way to go. So I will try to summarize and post in the mailing list. And for example, in 1 month, if there is no activities, then in the next APNIC meeting, we will formally close this action item. Top of that? Okay, thank you very much. Then we will have the presentations, and the first one will be given by Randy Bush. Yes.
Okay, I'm Randy Bush, IIJ, and University of Oregon, another strange place. And this is about
Yeah.
clients. Thank you. This is about, from the ops and ISP and RIR perspective of a PKI, and this is different than what Steve was telling you at the keynote. And just in case why you wonder what Eid al-Fitr is, it's the last day of Ramadan when you go with your family. And the key thing is why I'm using it is it's the breaking of the fasting period and of all evil habits. And the evil habits I want to break are the unknown quality of the Whois data. Unknown is a nice word. The unknown quality of the IRR data, and where unknown, again, is a nice word, right? There is no formal means of verifying if a new customer really owns the IP space they're asking me to announce. There is no formal means of verifying routing announcements. Okay? I want an end to this stuff. Okay? There's a big gap in routing security, and it's not router security, worrying about attacking a router. That is a major problem. But it's that protocols, legally, the BGP protocol can be used to tell lies, route hijacking, et cetera, et cetera. I did a JANOG presentation on this. I'll also do it in the afternoon in the routing SIG, an updated version of this, talking about routing security. But the big gap in that discussion is storing and moving the certificates. So what's the PKI? It's the public key infrastructure, and it's a database that can be a single database, could be distributed, et cetera, et cetera. It contains the certificates identifying the RIRs, identifying the ISPs and end sites, and it contains the delegations of IP addresses and the delegation of AS numbers in a formal sense. Wrong button. Oh, great. Now we have to learn how to deal with that. Okay. An attestation, in other words, somebody saying formally that entity owns this IP space or this AS, specifies the identity, i.e. the public key of the recipient. I'm failing?
No, the next door is getting your...
I'd like to share.
Okay, so it specifies the public key of the recipient, and it specifies what's being delegated. And it's signed by the key, by the private key of the entity allocating it. In other words, and I'll go through examples, and it because the IP and AS stuff follows the allocation hierarchy. The IANA to the RIRs, the RIRs to ISPs, to downstream ISPs, to end user enterprises. Okay? And a delegation, each delegation looks like this. There's an attribute certification that says, I'm going to do an IP space. It's the same for an AS number. There's the description of the space being delegated and when that expires. Because when I contract with the registry to get some space, that contract has a term. And so that registry is going to give me that space for the length of the contract, probably plus 30 or 90 days or something for, you know, an operational slop cushion. But that has an expiry. Then there is my name, my identity, and my public key. And that public key is the crypto version of my identity, because if I sign something with my private key, you can know that I signed it. And now let's remember, this says what's being allocated. This says to whom it is being allocated. But who is allocating it? It's signed, this whole package is signed by the delegator. In other words, the RIR signs the packaging of what is being allocated, for how long, to whom it is being allocated. Okay? Feel free to interrupt me, by the way. But what I'm trying to do here is model most simply what we actually do. Okay? And wrap reasonable crypto around it. Okay? Now, here's an example. Here's my identity cert. RGNet is a name under which I operate some infrastructure, and my public key. Here is some address space, and it's going to be given to me for 1 year plus a three-month cushion. I don't think I'm going to pay an RIR very much for that particular address space, but... And it is signed by APNIC's private key, so that anybody can use APNIC's public key, see that indeed APNIC did sign this, see this, and that I have it. Okay? And the way it would work in a delegation chain is IANA would allocate to an IRR, 192/8. So that's the attribute cert. It would have a allocation period, probably quite long from the IANA, and the RIR's identity cert, and it would be signed by the IANA. Okay, this notation reasonable? Okay. The RIR would allocate to an ISP, 192.168/16, the ISP signed by the RIR. The ISP could allocate to a user site, 192.168.42/24, the user's identity wrapped by the ISP. And anyone can verify that this is true, because the public keys are in the PKI, and you can follow this up to the IANA root. Now notice that IANA is the root for ASNs and for IP address space. But as I will continue, it is not the root for anybody's identity. And this is where I strongly disagree with Steve Kent. Okay? Because I don't think the RIRs want their identities owned by the IANA, and I don't think I want my identity, my ability to route, owned by the RIR. I've made an agreement over a lease time of an address space, but not over my identity. But what's cute about this, by the way, when people tell you, oh, this crypto's expensive, when you receive these data, you can verify them right there and mark them as checked. So you don't have to verify it in real time.
You have a plan to notify to the third party after
they fixed that
meeting.
Problem.
And
no, just give me the other mic back, Clarence. And then I'll go over there and talk. And no, let's see. So, an ISP and an end site, their certificate, their identity, can be acquired anywhere from Thought, VeriSign, Self-Signed Cert, etc. The RIRs, in most cases, there are lots of small ISPs, etc. They're not going to want to go somewhere to get a cert. They're going to come to the RIR and say, for $25, please give me a cert. That's going to be the 97% case. But for those of us who operate in multiple regions, right? I want one identity. I don't want an APNIC identity and an ARIN identity and a LACNIC identity and an AFRINIC identity. 1, 2, 3, 4. Who did I leave out? Oh, RIPE identity. Speak for yourself. Ray shouldn't have to tell me. I want one identity. And what's interesting is these certificates, my identity certificate for an ISP or IR, they don't need an attestation. They don't need to be signed by somebody upstairs, because they are only used two ways. They're used in a business transaction. So when I become a member of APNIC, I sign a contract, and just like that contract says, my identity is RGNet with an address, et cetera, I give them my certificate. And I say, this is another representation of my identity, and it's bound by contract. So when I want to do business with APNIC, signing something with that key, APNIC knows that's the contractual key. It's bound to the contract. It's not bound to the IANA. And that's really what an RIR wants. It wants a contract with me and that key to be that contract with me. Okay? And the other thing it's used is binding it to an IP or an ASN attestation by the upstream. That's the only other case, the one I showed you. And all that, it makes no difference that somebody says, I have checked this really is RGNet because it was bound by the contract with the allocator. A downstream ISP for me makes a contract, just like with the RIR, I make a contract with the RIR, an Insight who buys service from me gives me their cert, and I allocate space to them. And that, all that matters is that is the contractually binding identity. So none of us need IANA to certify who we are. IANA should not be a identity attesting agency. The RIRs are the same. Your identity is your public key, which is part of the cert. You can get your cert from the IANA, the RIR, the NRO, or you can get it from Thought, or you VeriSign, or a self-signed cert. It makes no difference. The difficult problems we're going to have with these identities is key rollover and revocation in case of security breaches, et cetera. Okay, but I don't want to descend there here because then we get pretty complex. Okay? So how's this fit together in a PKI? Well, here's the bucket we're going to throw it in. Okay, here's the RIR. When I joined the RIR, I gave them my cert. Now, remember, in 95% of the cases, I got that cert from them because I don't want to be know how to generate certs or any of that stuff. I'm just a small little ISP. I want to move packets, like Jeff said. I don't want to get involved in certs. But some organizations are very conscious of their certification, are very conscious of their security procedures, are very conscious of who and what they authorized to do what. Okay? Telstra, I believe, paid tens of thousands of dollars to get to become a formal CA. They don't want to get their identity from someone else. Okay? So the ISP, when they sign the registry contract, tells the registry the identity. The registry can give them ASNs and addresses in that wrapping I showed you before, the registry signing the binding of the space to the ISP's identity, and it goes into the database. Similarly, when a downstream ISP contracts with an upstream ISP, they hand over their cert, and the upstream ISP might generate certs for them. Large ISPs like UUNET, Telstra, et cetera, could have, oh, you want a cert? We have cert-making facilities. We'll make a cert for you. But you own that cert. That's you. I don't own you. I haven't signed the cert or anything saying I know formally who you are. I just created one for you. As a service, and then I can allocate space. I can put your cert in the database, I put my cert in the database, and I can attest to all the sub-allocations I give you. Similarly, this ISP to an Insight can do the same certificate exchange. It puts the cert in the database, and it attests to the addresses it's handed down there. And this site puts their cert in the database. Okay? So, there are also people who want to just take the database's input for research, auditing, testing, validation, et cetera. And all these transactions are interesting, and we need to watch them. Now, of course, I don't believe in one central database. That's not going to work, right, operationally, network partitions, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to have to be replicated, et cetera. What's fun about a PKI, oh, pardon me, let's go back to the transactions. I'm poor at doing this, excuse me. So what do you do to go back? Page up, there we go. These transactions, I'm not firmly fixed on this model, but there are some RFCs that help us with this if they fit our need. And that's RFC 2585 describes some FTP and HTTP transport for the PKI, but it also describes interfaces and the transactions for putting and getting certs into a PKI. An important thing to note is a PKI is self-authenticating because it's just a bundle of certs and you can traverse it and validate them. So there is no need for a secure transport when moving it because you can just test it for validity standalone. It is self-certifying. Okay? So making those replica here is trivial. No special protocol needed to transport this securely, to know, to checksum it, that kind of stuff. Okay? The RIRs are going to need some tools. They're going to want to generate and receive ISP certs. They're going to want to receive space from the IANA. They're going to want to attest. They're going to want to sign allocations to ISPs, and they want to manage their own keys. Okay? Now, what's interesting is the different RIRs might have different ways of doing this. APNIC is going to want to wrap it in, Paul, what it's my APNIC? Is it this rather nice web interface where you interact with them, et cetera, whereas RIPE may do it with their way of looking at it and viewing it. But what's key about this scheme is there's a common underlying tool set, and then each of them presents the underlying data structure and transactions in fitting their business model and their user interface model. By the way, Izumi-san, this extends to NIRs for an extra fee. Okay. ISPs, of course, want to do validation that a customer... How might this thing start to be used? What's going to be the deployment over time? The first thing is, right next week when this is finished, if you believe that, that when somebody comes to me and says, please route my IP space, I can check that indeed, manually, I can check, do they really own that IP space? Not by looking it up in who is, but by looking at an actually formally verifiable crypto chain that goes all the way to the IANA. Then next year, or right now also, I can debug hijacking. I can say, you say that somebody hijacked your space, I can say, they were allocated that space. Here it is, signed right here. They're not hijacking it. You never owned it. Next. Coffee break? Yes, it is. No, we just had coffee break. Somebody's phone. Leo, it's yours. Okay. Next year, you know, when I build my route filters for my routers, for my peers, to filter for bad announcements, instead of just looking in the IRR, I can validate that data. Or I can throw the IRR entirely away eventually and have formally validatable data on which to build those filters. And Jeff Houston believes this is what people will use for the next 5 years. And 5 years from now, we'll actually run secured BGP in the routers when the crypto and the routers guys catch up. Okay? But note also that this scheme does not care, it does not, it works and does not care about the war between SOBGP, SBGP, PGBGP, SPGBGP, and all those contenders for what's the right way to secure BGP. Just for the record, I happen to agree with Steve Kent. I like SBGP, but that's my personal prejudice. We can go into that somewhere else. Okay? But this is agnostic to that. Okay? The ISPs want to generate or acquire our own identities. We want to register roles with the upstreams. This is new, and I haven't shown you this, but if I'm a big ISP, I'm going to have a department that does financial transactions. So I'm going to generate a cert that I'm going to tell APNIC, here is the public key which you can use to decrypt financial transactions. That is separate from the one that I'm going to generate to request IP space. That's separate from the one I'm going to talk to you about how I want the DNS change, because those are different departments, and I am a big enough organization that I manage my own authorization and security model. And so I manage who can use what key internally through my normal organizational security procedures, and I want to tell the RIR which cert will be used for which kind of transactions, business transactions, roles with the RIR. Okay? Whereas APNIC, I don't think they've shown it, but APNIC has a cute thing that they're going to do for the simpler, smaller ISP that has the different roles, but you get your cert from APNIC and you check the boxes that say, hey, you can use this for this function, you can use this for that function. And so it scales, this whole scheme scales from that to the very complex large organization that manages their own security policy. Okay? You can generate certs for downstream ISPs, end users, customers, etc. And you can sign allocations of IP space and ASNs to downstreams, ISPs, and end users. Though I would note ISPs tend not to delegate ASNs. But they can. Okay, some open tough issues. Coordinating of updates, one central repository just isn't operationally feasible. Okay, there is an LDAP v3 mapping for authentication methods. LDAP was designed to hold these kinds of certificates. I'm not sure it's what I want. I've always been a little afraid of LDAP. Large organizations tend to like it. But I'm not sure. You know, I'm a MySQL guy. But this is actually supposed to do the proper job. And if it doesn't, I'm tempted to go to the designers and say, give me LDAP v4, please, and this is what I need. Right? Supposedly, the ITF is there to meet our needs. We're not here to meet the ITF's needs. Okay? So that could be a very good and LDAP provides for both distribution and replication. Right? So theoretically, this might work for us. Rollover and revocation, i.e., what happens when the IANA's certificate gets compromised? Okay, open issue. Both with roots and the RIRs and with ISPs. So there may be a separate secured communication transport channel necessary to discuss revocation and maintenance of the critical certs. I think that's the story. Yes. These are the kind folks that help me eat, and they do too. And Steve Bellevin, Mr. Firewall, and J.I., his cohort over at Columbia, also work with me heavily on this. Ed.
Yeah, I've seen this before, so that's why I have some comments right away.
Go.
Can you go to slide 7? I've got to challenge your skills with the – oh, cool. You said you have the lease on slide 7, lease expiry. Do you think that's the right word to use it? Because I don't think we really lease the space from the RIRs.
I don't care to get into that politics. Is there a politically neutral word you would suggest?
No, I'm just going to throw that out. It's sort of a rhetorical question.
I think the RIRs, hey, RIRs, what do you think the verb is?
Sometimes some of it might use the word lease, but I think that's concept of lease is probably closer to what the relationship is as opposed to the concept of buy and sell.
Well, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Buy and sell wouldn't need an expiry. And by the way, why I don't want these, why these, each one is separate, each delegation is separate, is because even though I could have a contract with Aaron for leased address space, and my contract is 3 years long, I might also, and in fact do, have an experimental allocation that's 1 year long, and then there's the whole legacy issue. So I see the granularity of this as, let Ed finish, or unless it, you're on the same subject.
The other thing is that you could just apply the term of the lease to the cert itself. And
to this cert. It is. This is an attribute.
I'm saying the concept of the lease is applied against the cert, not against the resource.
Is it you're leasing the attestation, not leasing the space.
Okay. Okay.
The only reason why I brought this up is because I remember last time we talked about this, that you were concerned about the IRs being the Lord Master over the ISP's operations, and that's what I was reacting
well,
to.
Well, that's why this is a separate
right
entity. That solves the key problem is I can continue to route
right.
even though my contract with them is ended.
Because actually on slide 12 is the next is part of the same comment that I think if you drew slide 12, and I don't want to really edit your slides right now, but if you had a second oval of IR, I mean, you have the IRs stacked up, but if the IRs were, there's two IRs on the picture, you'd really show the ISP is not under the RIR, which on Steve Kent's drawing this morning shows like IANA, RIR.
IANA owns us all under Steve Kent's drawing.
Right.
I just can't.
So I finally got that looking at the slide. Oh, you're talking about the ISPs live between the RIRs, not under the RIRs. So.
Right.
So I think in that slide, that would really show it, as opposed to what Steve had.
Beat me up afterwards.
Sure. The next one, slide 13. You had the last bullet, no need for transport security. That's true if you consider only that when I get it, I can dual security. The problem is, can I get it? Something like DOS attack type security or someone.
Right.
So you do have, and you
right.
talk about that later in the second
right.
channel.
Right.
Paul. Hello, Paul Wilson from APNIC. I just wanted to raise an issue with you, Randy, and just clarify.
By the way, one thing, Paul gets credit for changing something I was doing into adder certs.
Oh, thank you. it is to do with the attribute certificates and the identity certificates, and the idea of that structure is so that you can separate the process of authentication from authorization. And you've mentioned that... you can use a identity certificate, PKC, from anywhere, which is technically true. The RIRs, however, are regarded as being in the business of identifying people. And the Whois database, I think, is a good example of that. When someone looks up a Whois record, they assume that the RIR has actually identified the person who's holding that record, so that when you know, it's not an alias or an anonymous allocation, and so that's my view. That's that's how I think the RIRs see themselves. So the issue of, for instance, attaching an attribute certificate to a self-signed certificate is something that's technically possible and certainly could be done, provided there is an identification process that goes on as well. So we would go through whatever processes we need to satisfy the local policy. And, of course, we trust our own certificates implicitly. We might trust other RIR certificates implicitly. We might trust various other CAs. But a self-signed certificate is a very good example of one which we would say, well, just because it's a certificate doesn't mean anything. We would go through.
Well, let's remember what's hidden here also is all the details of the naming part of the cert. And when you chose to wrap this, you can choose whether or not to test to it.
Yeah. I'm not saying yet whether this is replacing who is.
Right. Yeah, okay. I'm just clarifying
that. I want
that
to stay out of that for the moment.
There has been a sort of discussion about possibly completely anonymous, unidentified, or randomly generated IDs floating around. But at
and
some
there's
point,
the whole question of residential customers should not be made. I think we know this. I think this scheme maps well enough those parts of the operational and administrative aspects that we understand that we have some instincts of how we might solve these other problems if we agreed on how they should be solved.
Sure. Okay.
I think Herr Volk wanted to comment on that particular point.
Yes. Well, okay. Paul, I certainly don't think that the IRR's business in identifying their clients, it's in giving unique identifiers to the clients.
Actually, the IRRs do identify the client, but if we want to go down there, the identity of the client is actually in the paper contract.
Can I comment?
Well, I don't know. What the heck? Go
speak,
for it.
I could speak from personal experience that is the business of the IRRs, and I've got several legal cases to prove it. And some court records and some potential investigations by legal authorities to persons making allegations of being someone other than they are in an attempt to attain an address space. So I think identity is part of our business.
But, Ray, would you accept that that's on the paper side?
Yeah.
Right.
It's on the paper side.
Right. And we may in time understand the mapping better of the paper identity to how we want to identify people. You may want to sign a binding of this thing to a who is record if the who is kept alive, for instance.
I think the identity is kept on paper, sure, but the who is database is all about third parties out there on the internet being able to know who is using address space, and I think I understand that's a fairly common expectation among law enforcement, for instance, that you see some traffic coming from somewhere, you use the Whois database to find out who it is that's got it. And
well, I'll quote Jeff Schiller on that one.
Well, okay.
Law enforcement is made too easy, we call it a police state. I think if we understand what we want, there are many ways to get there. As I said, one thing you could do is, you just can't knock the cable. You've got to plug it in. Picky, picky. One thing we could do is you could sign the binding of this to Whois data if you decide to keep the Whois data there. Jeff.
I'm going to move away from that. Oh, I think one could explore this identity issue for a long, long time. There's a lot to say.
There's actually
a lot to say and a lot to work through in terms of whether this is almost a banknote style that doesn't include identity loading or it truly is an attribute of identity. There's something I really picked up on from what you said that I'm confused about and something else that I'm going to ask you that's exploratory. The first one I really picked up, you have a date there on your resource attribute certificate, a validity date. It's not the date it was created, it's the validity date.
Probably both are there.
And then you said in text, verbally here, I can keep on routing for as long as, and you seem to imply that even when the date after that date, if you present me as your upstream, why should I believe you?
No. Sorry. What I meant was that this date, my identity does not expire on this date.
In a routing context.
In a routing context, what I haven't shown because I slipped in is that I wanted to do another, which is what does a router see? What a router sees is this and the AS one.
Yes.
Okay, that's very similar. And so it sees, and it goes up the chain, and it sees, yes, that ISP has that AS, and yes, that ISP has this space. That ISP might have other ASs and other space.
And my point is that just because my contract with APNIC expired on this date, my contract with Aaron may not have, my legacy space may not have, and what expired was this, my control over this space, not my ability to route.
Okay, I would use a different terminology than ability to route, but I understand what you're
saying. And look at Steve Kent's model, and you will see problems in that area.
Okay, but your ability to route 192.168.42
will expire.
Has a problem in terms of a lifetime.
Correct.
Absolutely. The other question, which is actually more exploratory, and thank you for that clarification because it matches what I was thinking.
No charge.
Cool. We have intermediaries who themselves generate certificates.
Stimmt.
And certainly APNIC, as it knows, did do a CA bit set on its experimental model. Where does the CA bit sit in your attribute certificate model? How do, if you will, subordinate entities like this LIR then become...
Attribute certificates do not have keys.
Correct.
So the idea that they... Our CA has their CA bit set, I don't think has operational meaning.
There's no such thing as a CA bit. So then how do we support LIRs doing the same game?
I believe it is in the naming structure.
So
you can go up the tree. I think this one was the interesting one. So... She presented me with this user did, and I can go up to the ISP by the enclosing scope.
Or by an explicitly listed parent, or do I have to search for scope? I'm sorry, I'm fairly drilling down here, and everyone's trying to, why is Jeff down here in this hole?
I will not, I'm over 60 years old, so I know how to say, I don't know. I believe that both of those are doable. You and I are both in the habit of keeping prefix lists in trees with scope.
Okay.
But I don't know if that's going to be the ideal way to store these attestations. So possibly links to parent may be doable, may be what you want. It's not clear to me. What is also interesting to me is I don't think this is a unique name in the certificate space, because I could go to the RIR and say, my customer Sam needs a /16, and the RIR will give it to me, and I will give it to Sam.
Oh, okay. So across the entire space, the same IP address is inside.
The same prefix may not be unique. So I believe we need to scratch our heads just a little more on this, which is good. We have to earn our salary somehow.
Oh, for further study is a fine answer. I was just sort of wondering if I'd missed something there that was actually inside.
I've run out of magic.
Cool. Thanks.
Someone may pick it up around back from area with the chairs towards registry to desk in level 3. If you have someone else back, by mistake, please bring it back to every card registry to area as soon as possible. The owner's business card, Vita Winto, is inserted in the back's name card. It's on the back. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Izumi Okutani, and I work for a national internet registry in Japan called JPNIC. In this presentation, I would like to introduce the data privacy issues that we are currently discussing in Japan regarding information handling in our WHOIS database. And I'm interested to know, after the end of my presentation, the situation in other RIRs, and, well, I'm not sure if the other NIRs are here, but other registries, and also from the perspective of WHOIS users' point of view regarding information query and registering information in WHOIS. So just to explain the background a little bit, I think you probably share more or less this kind of situation, not just in Japan, but the situation surrounding WHOIS is changing. It's not really the same as in the early days of the internet. And because internet is now much more closely related to the social economic activities of just ordinary people, not just close to the people in this industry. So as a result of this, information that's been disclosed in WHOIS also affects people's social and economic lives directly. And just to give you some specific examples about the situation in Japan, with our case, more and more end users have their information registered in their WHOIS. Under the APNIC policy, they are supposed to register their assignment if they receive assignments larger than /30. And I think when this policy was made, it was the idea was that people who receive assignments larger than this size would be people who have enough network skills and they set up their own servers in for their network, so they would be have qualified enough skills as POCs. However, with the spread of voice over IP or family type service, more and more end users receive several fixed IP addresses. So people who don't have network admin skills have their information registered in their WHOIS. And even if you contact these people, they can't do much about anything to deal with network problems. And another thing is, I'm sure that most of you are very, very aware, people who are registered as POCs are being the heavy target of spams. And it can be a really, really serious problem, especially, business-wise. And the third is this law to protect data privacy for people. It was enacted in the year 2004. So people's awareness is starting to change. The initial intention of the law was to make sure adequate handling of personal information would be, implemented. But as a result of this, more and people are starting to feel that they have the right to request for hiding the information for regarding their personal data. So the trend in Japan at the moment is they want as less information as disclosed as possible regarding their personal information. So I suppose the necessary measures would be, well, it's pretty obvious, try to have as less exposure of private information as possible and encourage more people to who have network admin skills to be registered in their as POCs instead of end users who don't really have much clue about how to deal with network problems. So this is just my understanding of measures taken by APNIC. So if it's not correct, please point it out. I think a proposal was passed in 2004. I'm not sure the exact date, but to that all assignments must be registered in WHOIS as it had been in the past. However, this information can be hidden from WHOIS query. In the other words, when people query the WHOIS, it just displays the information of the allocation above this assignment, and the assignment information can be hidden. This is not, I think you can choose whether to hide or disclose. And the second thing that APNIC has been implementing for quite some time is that LIRs can substitute as POCs. And the third would be, I think you have role objects. So in other words, people who don't want to, provide their private emails, they can, register like group emails. And that would kind of avoid spams to your personal account. And measures taken by JPNIC is more or less similar regarding the fact that LIRs can substitute as POCs, and also we also have world objects. But actually, this proposal to hide the total end user's assignment information did not reach consensus in Japan, because people feel that they would like to at least confirm whether an assignment has been made or not. Or maybe, you know, even if it's not like too personal information, they want to have a little bit more information regarding this assignment. That was the general sentiment. Therefore, the measures we take at the moment is that we didn't hide the total assignment information, but we hide a part of the information. And another thing is, I'm not sure about how the implementation of by other RIRs, but with our case, we used to provide bulk Whois data for like research purpose and things in the past. But this kind of information also affects our law in Japan. So we have stopped providing such data except to APNIC. So just to explain a little bit into details of how we actually implement this. Firstly, regarding the INetNam object, we hide the postal address related field. They have to register this information as well, but it's actually not displayed on our Whois. And the idea behind it is that when we have network problems, people don't really send postal mails to dissolve, you know, this kind of problems. They just make phone calls or, you know, send emails. So it's not much use. That's why we hide this information. And also, email address used to be displayed for notified and last update fields. But these kind of emails are not the email address for network troubleshooting. So that's why we've hidden this information as well. I think, have I gone too much? Okay. And the next is regarding the person object. It's pretty much the same as the INetNam in the fact that we hide the address-related field. And another thing we do is that for admin C, we also hide the phone and fax field. It's open. It's disclosed for technical contact. But phone and fax is hidden for admin C because we distinguish technical contact and admin contact as the admin people are the people who make the final decision about how to handle the network. And technical people are the people who actually look over the daily operations. So maybe they don't need to be contacted as urgently by phone as technical contacts. That's why we hide this information. However, even though we've taken these measures, we still have some further issues, and maybe some end users just don't want to have any of their information exposed on their Whois. So maybe that, you know, we should take further measures to protect this, you know, information for users. And another thing is that are there any ways to minimize the impact of spams for POCs? These are the two issues that we're trying to, you know, still look for. And maybe one of this is just a brainstorm of possible solutions. And yeah, it could be possible that we just implement exactly the same policy as APNIC. We just hide the total assignment information. But some people feel maybe we can have an intermediate policy where people can choose to totally hide the information, but also, you know, they can disclose, they can hide a part of the information, or they disclose everything, or, you know, try to think of an intermediate policy, or upgrade the user assignment size to /29. So from current /30, if we upgrade it to /29, maybe most of the end users who currently receive voice over IP or fixed IP service would not be affected. It would then all be registered as ISP's assignments. So most of the people who would register the assignment will be corporate users. Maybe that's one option. And also, another possibility could be we just hide the information for SOHO or home users and not just the corporate users. But each has some pros and cons, and we're still under discussions what would be a good solution. So we've set up a working group on this matter in December last year, and we have 12 volunteers, out of which 7 of them are LIRs, And what we plan to do is draft a proposal by our next JPNIC open policy meeting, which is like this meeting, and it's going to be the next one is going to be in the summer. So we are trying to draft a proposal on who is registration policy in Japan. And the basic principles underneath this would be consider data privacy, minimize spam impact, and it should be consistent with APNIC or other RIRs policy. So we try to, you know, come up with something that's consistent with these three principles. So that's basically the situation in Japan, and I would be very interested to know how are the operations. Do other RIRs or APNIC face these kind of issues? Or from end users' point of view, or as an LIR registering WHOIS information, do you have any requests regarding WHOIS information handling or disclosure? That's it from me.
Any questions?
Hi, Leo Vigoda, RIPE NCC.
Hi.
We have similar laws to Japan on data protection, and we don't have a formal policy on implementing those laws, mm-hmm. but I suspect we probably will at some point. So we're facing the same issues that you are.
Are there any measures to protect personal data by RIPE, such as, I don't know, you allow substitution of POCs by LIRs, or it's not formally written?
Well, what we encourage people to do is not to just not register stuff, but to actually go and put, on the whole, the reason that you don't want to register personal contact information is because it's an end user, and the end user is not actually competent to help anyone in any case. There's
exactly.
no point in registering that information in the database. Mm-hmm. You can only contact them, and they say, "Well, I clicked on the button," you know, and that's not very helpful. Mm-hmm. So, generally, we would encourage people if they have an issue where they don't want to register their end users' information in the database to register their own information and go and make it clear in the InetNum object that they have registered their own information. Mm-hmm. And that's generally how we would recommend people do it.
I see. Thank you.
Ray Polzak from Aaron. This whole matter is actually under discussion in the Aaron region, and there's a couple of fundamental questions you really have to ask yourself with this. And first of all, the reasons you collect information may intersect with the reasons why you display information, but they're not necessarily the same reason. I will collect a lot of information and never display it because I'm doing other things. For example, when Aaron is trying to identify who they are going to potentially give resources to, they ask for a lot of information that never, ever gets even put into the database per se, but exists as supporting documentation. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, there's information that's collected that you want to have publicly displayed. Mm-hmm. But you have to ask yourself the question is, with every piece of information you're going to display, why is it are you going to display it? Not what are you going to withhold, but what are you going to display? So you have to fundamentally say to yourself, when I create a directory, and you actually have multiple directories that are presented with one face and you call it WHOIS, but you're providing information regarding DNS, you're providing information to help people do network troubleshooting. You're providing information that could be used to identifying persons to do peering with. You could be providing information to provide regarding people of contact in case of network abuse. But you have to identify what is it that you want to display. Why do you want to display it? Once you identify why you want to display something, you just, then you have to discuss what it is that you really need to show about that to the public. Now, right. With regard to what's held privately, and you raised up the bulk who is issue, here again, you have to actually discern what it is that you're going to release and why you would be re-releasing it. In other words, the research community generally has got a plan about what they want to do. Now, there is no reason why you could not make it a little bit more tailored as far as what you provide. Right, basically, right now, you just get a dump of everything, and that may not be the solution. For example, if a researcher is interested only in knowing the geographical area, and undefined what that area may be for purposes of discussion, and why then do they need to know other information from the database, such as the DNS information? So you have to answer those fundamental questions. Once you do that, then all the rest of your matters, I think, will be taken care of.
Yes, thank you very much. We are very aware of the three issues that you've pointed out as well, but we haven't found yet a very good answer yet. So, yeah, exactly. Thank you for your input, Ray.
Adieu. Brian Cathis, privileges.
Adiel, Adiel Aplogan from Afrinic. First, I have a question, and then I'll say also what we do. About the book whois, you said that you just stopped providing book whois to
Yes,
to
that's
research.
Right. Uh-huh.
So, as you can remove contact information from the whois or hit them in the whois, mm-hmm. why don't you just wipe the contact information from the book whois and provide the information to those who need them? That is something we do at
right.
Afrinic.
Uh-huh.
The book, we remove contact information from it.
Go ahead first.
Secondly, we in our region, we don't have that privacy enforcement law. For you, it's within a country, so you have to apply. So in our region, we don't have that issue broadly raised by the community, so we don't have any measure to hit contact information. But one issue we are thinking of, and it's about the spam, the use of the information for spam. Even if you don't have the privacy issue, we can have complaints from people who found their email being used by spammer to do that. So it will be something we'll discuss with the community and see how to deal with it.
Thank you very much. Regarding the first point, we actually, you know, thought about this as well, trying to restrict the kind of information we provide in bulk whois. We've consulted our lawyer, and the reply was really, really strict. Like, the lawyer considers that an IP address can be considered a personal information as well, because that's the information. This information can be used to identify an end user. So it's quite a strict kind of implementation, but that was the reply we got from the lawyer. So we're like kind of, you know, implementing in a little bit strict way. That's our situation.
Two comments. The first one, I think from an internet security geek's point of view, Ray's discussion was really analogous to open up the ports which you think are going to be needed. Mm-hmm. Default, everything is closed. So somebody wants bulk whois, what's your research about? Issue the query that answers that those data and produce it, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the second point is, Izumi-san, I am your customer and member, and I want to know, I'm considering the whois data is mostly used for spam. As an engineer, why do you publish my phone number and not the administrator's? I think the administrator should get the spam, and I should be protected because I have real work to do.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, we'll try to. I'll put this input to a working group and, yeah, discuss it.
Any other questions? Comments? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Last one will be the right CC update.
Wow, it's nearly working. Okay, hello, my name's Leo Vigoda. I'm the Registration Services Manager at the RIPE NCC, and I've been asked to give a little update on what's happened with the RIPE WHOIS database since we last gave an update at this SIG, probably a couple of meetings ago. I've only got 7 slides, so I shouldn't keep you from lunch. We made a change to the way that we deal with looking for abuse contacts and the way that we respond to WHOIS queries. There was about a year's discussion, maybe a bit more, and there was a lot of discussion about how we should limit access in the database to email addresses that were used inappropriately by people that complain about your computer pinged my computer and that sort of thing. So what we ended up with was 2 things. When you do a regular ordinary WHOIS query to whois.ripe.net, the only information that is displayed is the registration data and the abuse mailbox. But information about the email addresses in the changed lines and various other email addresses that appear in the response are filtered out. You can use a WHOIS query flag, I think it's -B, -B, to undo that. But that's something that we do to try and minimize the anti-spammers that send a lot of spam. At the same time, we added in the abuse mailbox attribute in a number of classes, person, role, and organization. Abuse mailbox just takes a regular, ordinary email address. There was discussion about whether it should take a nick handle or some sort so that you could do a query on the nick handle to come up with all sorts of other information. Eventually, it was decided to go for the very, very simple option of just including an email address. At the same time, the trouble attribute in the role class was removed, and that's no longer there. Those are some changes made to the classes that we have in the database and also the responses that you get to queries. We've done an update to incorporate RPSLNG in the current version of the database. You can create root 6 objects. You can describe your IPv6 and multicast routing policies in the RIPE WHOIS database now. It's all based on RFC 2012, and it's been available for a bit more than a year now. And it seems to work. We've also implemented some support for DNSSEC in the WHOIS database because we've been implementing DNSSEC on all the reverse zones that we have. And we needed to incorporate the DSR data attribute in domain objects. So if you want to sign your zones and you need to include this information, you can modify your domain objects and it all works. It's been tested by real live customers that actually wanted to do it. So that's pretty good. At the same time, included in this slide, we've got something which isn't really related to DNSSEC. It's just we expire PGP signed updates after a week. Basically, this is because lots of people still send WHOIS updates via email, and they may not have a direct connection with our network. That means their email is sent over someone else's network. It transits their network. Theoretically, they could go looking for updates sent to auto-dbm@ripe.net, capture the PGP sign update, and then 3-4 months later go and revert an object back to what it was in a time before and cause some sort of confusion. So PGP signed updates now expire after a week. This isn't exactly DNSSEC related, it's sort of more generally security related, but it's an improvement that we introduced a short while back. We've also implemented an Iris server. Iris is part of the CRISP project. It says here replacement for Whois. I'm not sure if it's necessarily a replacement or it's something that will sit alongside Whois. But the idea is that it's got really cool referral and stuff like that built into it. There are a number of different registry types in CRISP, domain registry and other types. We've implemented AREG, which is the address registry type, and it has support for IP addresses and AS numbers. We're running a prototype Iris server. It's based on the VeriSign Labs code, and it just gives exactly the same information that you can get from whois.ripe.net. If you go to the website, then you can download a little client, and you can give it a go yourself. It works, and it's there. So we've also released a slightly updated version of the Whois server software. We're at version 3.3.0. But what's perhaps more interesting is that we've made the server software available through CVS, and there's a URL for it there. If you want whatever the latest version is, you can just grab it from our CVS repository and go and do it that way. So you can always get the latest bits and bobs before we actually package it up as a release version, which may be useful for some people that use the Whois server software. And I think that's the last slide. Yeah, if you have any questions, then I'll do my best.
Hey, how many, on the DNSSEC, how many customers have signed their delegations from you, off the top of your head?
I don't know how many. I've seen discussions with at least one customer. Remembering that we've only implemented this like last few months, but definitely one customer has been trying it and reported bugs, and we fixed the bugs, and they tried it again, and it worked. So I know that we've actually got live customers using it, but I don't know the number. Oh, that reminds me. One other thing about the CVS, it's a read-only thing. You can't commit to the CVS. If you want to send something, you need to just pop us an email, and then we can implement it into a release version and stuff.
Rudiger Volk, Deutsche Telekom. Leo, you were saying with the Iris front end, you get exactly the same content as with Whois. That doesn't match with my understanding that actually there are different schemas involved, and there is not a one-to-one mapping.
I probably didn't speak very accurately. The data source is identical. Not all parts of the source are given out when you do the Iris query in the AREG registry class thing. So, yeah, you don't get, for instance, you don't get information about maintainers and stuff like that. You just get the information that you want. Okay, that looks like all the questions, so I should hand back to the chair.
So thank you. I believe that's how on the agenda. And okay, one thing I like to say, okay, it seems no at the beginning of before this SIG meeting, there is no any proposals, so we try really hard to try to get one. But it turns out like today's proposals are very interesting and very fruitful. So I encourage you participate in the mailing list and send the new proposals for the next APNIC database SIG meeting. So thank you very much. Okay, that's the time for lunch.